American Women. This is the story of women who have helped to develop the American way of life. Daughters of destiny, mothers of might, co-makers of history. Women whose names are written large upon the honor rolls of our nation's great.
Women courageous who have served and sacrificed, worked and dreamed, pioneered and persevered. Women whose names, deeds, and claims to fame have often been forgotten.
This is their story, and it is your story. 3 centuries of women whose deeds are rooted deep in our past and whose influence will reach far into the future. It's the story of you, the pioneer women of today, who are blazing the trails of tomorrow. The United States Office of Education and the National Broadcasting Company take pride in presenting the 11th chapter in this epic tale of women in the making of America. Today's chapter tells of the women who have helped to build one of the most important institutions in our nation, the American school. It's the story of women as teachers.
As the world begins a new year, a new decade, a voice from Europe is heard proclaiming harshly,
"This decade will see the end of democracy with its clumsy, outmoded system of representative government, its stupid encouragement of individual enterprise, its ridiculous ideal of universal education with freedom to learn, to think, and to speak."
But in the United States, another kind of voice is heard, that of the United States Commissioner of Education.
"The most important problem before the American nation today is to save the democracy of free learning, retaining our birthright of unhampered freedom to learn while molding the new economic future. That is the American way."
And from the teachers of America comes a pledge. From Amy H. Hinrichs, president of the National Education Association.
"We teachers pledge ourselves to guard the ideals of freedom on which this nation was founded, to make the schools centers of democratic living, to improve and equalize the education of all American children."
For 300 years, ever since early colonial days, the teachers of America have been the guardians of our future citizens. And the problems set by those teachers echo faintly down the years.
"If Jonathan had 3 apples, and James gave him 2 more, and William gave him 5 more.
Teaching, at first, only the rudiments of learning. For just as the girls did not study in the Latin grammar schools and universities, so the women did not teach in them.
But in the early morning hours, before the boys came to school, their sisters were allowed to sit on the benches and use their slates. And in the summer months, when the men teachers were busy in the field, the women took their places.
23 plus 13 divided by 9 equals..."
So the teaching profession grew, from apples to numbers, from printing to writing, from ABCs to the New England primer.
Ah, the New England primer. Many's the fine man and woman that was raised on it. It's a regular part of the American diet, like baked beans and corn pudding. It's taught millions to read, and not one to thin.
By 1760, the American colonies had a large percentage of citizens who could both read and write.
And as America's learning grew, so grew the work of her teachers. More and more women teaching more subjects.
Governesses in the homes of the well-to-do, teaching French and music. School mistresses in the new female seminaries, teaching embroidery and waxwork and French, English, geography.
And in New Orleans, where the second girls' school on the North American continent, the Ursuline Convent
had been established in 1735. Nuns were teaching Latin and church history, spreading a knowledge of the classics.
In a lonely little valley in Maryland, a religious teacher is struggling to establish another convent school. She is Elizabeth Ann Seaton, a widow and mother of five children, now directress of the nuns at Emmitsburg. In a rude shack with snow seeping through the cracks and wind tearing at the glazed paper windows.
And so Jesus came to the Sea of Galilee.
Mother Seaton, I'm so cold.
You poor child. Here, take my cloak.
Mother Seaton, thank you.
Now I'm older. God has given me more strength to bear hardship. Oh, if we can just persevere a little while longer, surely the men will come to mend our building.
It is not only the building, Mother Seaton. Our food is so low.
God will provide for us as he provides for the sparrows.
But perhaps we are flying in the face of providence, persisting in this school. We have so many hardships.
It is not for this school alone that I stay, though I dream of the day when it shall be a great, beautiful building with hundreds of pupils. But I see a greater day when each of you shall go out from here to establish other schools.
Other schools?
Yes, a vast number of schools. That is my dream, and now you know. If there is anyone among you who wishes to leave, to go back to the comfort and security of the convent, let her speak. I shall understand.
No one, Mother Seaton.
We would stay with you, whatever happened.
I am grateful for your loyalty. Let us thank the Lord for his many blessings. Let us praise him.
Contributed greatly to the development of schools in the United States, as did leaders of other churches who organized schools. But for this new nation, made up of peoples of every religion, church schools did not meet the whole need. In the words of America's dictionary maker, Noah Webster,
in a republican government, the whole power of education is required. Such a system as gives every citizen an opportunity of acquiring knowledge and fitting himself for places of trust.
1819. The New York legislature is meeting at Albany. Before the members stands Emma Willard, a school teacher, beautiful, poised, queenly.
Gentlemen, you vote money to provide a higher education for the men of this state. Why not for the women?
Why? Because their brains are too light, their forehead too small, their reasoning power too poor, and their emotions too unstable. Women will never make good students.
But I've already proved that they will. I've been teaching them in my home philosophy and geometry.
It would ruin a woman's health to study such things.
Gentlemen, all I ask is $2,000 to found a female academy.
Will higher education make women any better cooks and seamstresses?
It will make them better teachers and better mothers.
Nonsense. It'll only make them more ambitious.
It'll upset the whole order of things.
Governor Clinton, I appeal to you.
I believe in your plan, Miss Willard. Gentlemen, this is the only attempt ever made in this country to promote female education by the patronage of government.
It's a waste of public money.
No. I vote no.
No.
No. No.
No.
No.
No. No. No.
But Emma Willard had taken the first step toward a better tax-supported education for women. Eventually, she was to get her academy and instruct hundreds of younger women to carry on her work.
You owe it to your country to teach, for a few years at least. Go back to the schools you came from. Spread the knowledge you've gained. Freedom of learning is a human right. We must win that right for all America.
Square on the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides.
So the teaching profession grew from ciphering to geometry as more and more women taught more subjects.
But out on the frontier, where families traveled down the wilderness road and built little cabins far beyond the reach of the school, their parents were still the teachers, mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers. And at night, when the chores of the day were over, they would sit knitting before the fire.
Now tell us about the star, Granny, and the three wise men.
No, tell us about Aladdin.
Aladdin, I want to hear a real story about back in Pennsylvania. Boy, they have houses with an upstairs and a downstairs there, don't they, Granny? And barns for cows bigger than our whole cabin.
Well, leastways, the barns are bigger, Ezekiel.
Please, Granny, Aladdin.
Well, since you children can't agree upon a story, I think we'd better have some heavier learning this evening. Susanna?
Yes, Granny?
Isn't that the arithmetic book I wrote out for you lying over there on the table?
Yes, it is. I'll get it.
Mind your manners, child. Always say ma'am and sir to older people. And they never walk between anyone and the fire like that.
I'm sorry, Granny. I forgot.
Well, just because we live out here in the wild is no reason you young'uns should grow up like Indians. Now, turn to page 5. Got it?
Yes, ma'am. Oh, it's the problem about miles.
All right. Let's hear you read it. Ezekiel, you make ready to answer it.
If the distance from Philadelphia to Trenton is 30 miles, from Trenton to Princeton, 12 miles, and from Princeton to New York, 48 miles, how far is it from Philadelphia to New York?
Ezekiel?
Just a minute, I'm thinking. If the distance from Philadelphia to Trenton is... How far was it to Trenton?
I know the answer. It's 56 miles altogether.
Oh, no, Susanna. It's more than that.
It is not. I counted.
But it's got to be more. Shucks, what do girls know about counting?
Well, they know more than boys do.
They do not.
Well,
I'll bet you about that.
I think you'd better read the rest of that page.
Let's see. How far is it from Philadelphia to New York? Here it is. Politeness is the sunshine of the soul. And a family of well-regulated children is a charming sight.
But back in the East, where textbooks were printed instead of being written by hand, education was more formal. Women were still working to extend learning. And among them now was a woman poor in money, but rich in her dream of a better America, Mary Lyon.
1834. In the little sitting room at Ipswich Academy, two teachers face each other, two old friends. One, Zilpah Grant, head of the academy. The other, Mary Lyon.
And so, Zilpah, I've decided to leave Ipswich and start an academy of my own.
Oh, Mary.
And not to compete with yours. My school will be for poor girls. They will pay only $1.60 a week for board, room, and tuition.
But, Mary, you can't manage a school on that basis.
The students will help with the cleaning and cooking to make up the difference.
Well, perhaps.
Oh, Zilpah, it must succeed. I want poor girls to have an opportunity for higher education so they can learn to teach. And I want to train missionaries.
But where will you ever get the money to build a school?
I'm going to enlist the aid of influential men, Mr. Choate and Dr. Hitchcock.
But you'll need at least $25,000.
I'll get it somehow. I'll go from house to house collecting money. I'll go to women who were always too poor to go to school themselves, housewives and mothers. I will get it, Zilpah. I must.
And Mary Lyon did get it. $27,000, contributed by 1,300 different people in 91 towns. Contributions ranging from 6 cents to $1,000 for the academy that was to become Mount Holyoke College.
1839. In a little town in Connecticut,
an epoch-making event is taking place. Henry Barnard, young secretary of the state school board, has established a normal school to train the teachers. When the school board laughed at his scheme and refused to give any money for it, Barnard started the school at his own expense. And in Massachusetts, other normal schools were being established under the guidance of another great educator, Horace Mann.
I believe normal schools to be a new instrumentality in the advancement of the nation. The future of our nation depends upon our teachers, and our teachers depend upon the normal school.
The normal school. In 1840, a New York woman named Mertilla Minor established one in Washington, D.C.
So Negro people can get an education, too. In some states, it's a criminal offense to teach a slave how to read. Is that right? Surely the Lord didn't mean them to be ignorant. I believe that in education lies the salvation of the Negro race.
Beecher Stowe gave $1,000 to that Negro school.
And out in the West, where teachers were scarce and the need for education was great, her sister, Catherine Beecher, was establishing more schools to train more teachers.
Catherine pioneered in two directions. Westward, carrying the culture of the East to the new cities of the Mississippi Valley, and outward, broadening the curriculum. In her schools, girls studied strange new subjects, and parents came to complain.
Miss Beecher, what's all this we hear about Juliana studying bending?
Bending?
Yeah. She says somebody plays the reed organ and somebody else counts time, and she just stands there and tries to touch the floor.
Oh, you mean calisthenics.
That's it, Henry. Calisthenics.
Well, what I want to know is, what's that got to do with education?
Well, you see, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, we feel that it's just as important to train the body as the mind. If the future mothers of America have strong, healthy bodies...
It's tomfoolery, Miss Beecher. I ain't going to pay out good money for you to line my daughter to...
Teach your daughter, Henry.
Well, anyhow, I ain't going to do it. Not if Juliana don't never learn to touch the floor.
But in spite of objections, calisthenics remained in the program for the women of America, the forerunner of active sports. However, Catherine Beecher's greatest contribution was in training teachers to found more schools to train more teachers. For it was the teachers who led the march of education.
Extending learning upward for older people, downward for younger ones. Teachers establishing kindergarten. Margaretta Schurz in Wisconsin, Elizabeth Peabody in Boston, Susan Blow in St. Louis, thousands of teachers throughout the schools of America, yet until the Civil War, most of those teachers were men.
Men teachers marching out of the schools, women marching into them, men shouldering their muskets, women shouldering the responsibility of educating the youth of America.
Differential calculus treats of quantities as variables, of equations of variables.
So the teaching profession grew for women, from geometry to calculus, from primers to philosophy, to biology, astronomy, chemistry, physics.
Meanwhile, out on the western frontier, women were still teaching the rudiments of learning. In little red schoolhouses filled with children of assorted sizes and degrees of knowledge.
Can work at their arithmetic, while the sixth graders have spelling.
Okay.
You second and third graders can copy these words on your slate.
Yes, teacher.
And the seventh and eighth graders should study their McGuffey readers.
All right.
Now, is that all clear?
Hey, teacher, what are the fifth graders supposed to do?
Oh, well, you can join the spelling.
Teacher, Obadiah took my slate.
Obadiah.
Teacher, the fire's almost dead in the stove.
Well, will you go out to the wood box and fetch some sticks, please?
Hey, teacher, my Pa wants to know if you're boarding around at our house next week. Because if you are, he's got to put another bed in Jenny's room.
I'll talk to you about it after school, Tom.
Teacher.
Now, please, children, quiet down. Please, all of you. Get to work. You fifth and sixth graders, get your thinking caps on now. for I've some real sticklers for you to spell. Barnaby Waters.
Yes, teacher?
Spell Illinois.
Illinois?
Yes.
Illinois. Illinois.
Illinois! Illinois! The capital is Springfield, Illinois! Illinois! The capital is Springfield,
Illinois! Illinois! Teachers, foster mothers of future America. It was the teachers who led the march of education.
Susan Miller Dorsey of Los Angeles, a great administrative genius in American education, building the city school system from 46 schools to 380.
The building of schools was only an incident made necessary by the growth of our city. My own estimate of my work emphasizes the improvement of instruction and the exaltation of public education as a free gift to the children of all the people.
And Lucy Laney of Augusta, Georgia, founder of Haynes Institute for the Higher Education of Colored Children, persevering through floods, fires, malaria epidemics.
And the Lloyd Jones sisters of Wisconsin, who established a progressive school in America more than 50 years ago.
We weren't trying to be progressive. We were just trying to establish a way of life for the children that would be a home, a school, and a farm all in one. We felt that the life in study should be made just as interesting as the life outside of them. And we knew that learning is never dull, that only dull teachers make it so.
So they grew, the teachers, into a great understanding of education, into greater achievement in training the future citizens of America. By the turn of the century, the public school system offered the opportunity of teaching and learning both to men and women.
But the very young were still to be given greater opportunities for learning. And it was not long before women were extending education to the infant. At Teachers College, Columbia, Patty Smith Hill of Kentucky was conducting a nursery school for children below the age of four, with aspiring young teachers as the pupils. Amid a room full of toys and toddlers, they watched Miss Hill at work.
Why,
that's a beautiful house you drew, Bobby.
I'm going to draw a tree by it, and an automobile.
But you don't really teach them, do you, Miss Hill? I mean, you don't direct them as most kindergarten teachers do. You just let each child do whatever he wants to do.
Well, not quite. I do try to guide them in their choice. But here, you see, the child, not the teacher, is the important person. Instead of teaching them, I let them learn by doing.
But they seem so young. 3 and 4, and even some 2-year-olds.
Children are never too young to learn. I believe that if they begin to learn young enough, there's hardly any limit to their possibilities. If I'm right, then by the time these children have grown up, say, 20 years from now, the nursery schools will have gone along with them.
Everywhere Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Today, there are more than 2,000 nursery schools throughout the nation. Their only rivals in the race for popularity are the new schools for grown-ups, the adult education classes, the latest link in America's school system.
Today, in all the various types of schools that go to make up that system, are women as teachers. Women who have devoted their lives to the cause of American education.
Women like Vida Scudder and Mary Ellen Chase, teaching in the colleges, inspiring the youth of America to write good literature.
And administrators like Ella Flagg Young in Chicago and Mary D. Bradford, who for many years was superintendent of schools in Kenosha, Wisconsin, preserving the human element in a large school system.
And pioneers like Martha Berry, whose settlement schools have carried the light of learning into the shadows of the southern mountains, teaching agriculture, homemaking, trades, stimulating handicrafts.
Today, there are more women in the teaching profession than in any other, more than 800,000. Each year, the 200 teachers' training schools of the country produce 100,000 more.
Too many teachers? Not while there are still children to teach, and while there are still more than 4 million men and women in America who can neither read nor write. Not while we continue to make this country a democracy of free learning and continue to follow the American way.
America, 1940. In a school in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where children of 40 different nations are learning to live together, a young teacher finds two of her boys fighting.
I hate you!
Yannick Moreski. What is this?
Kosiko, he calls me Pollock.
I hate Yannick, too. Like my father hates his father. Like my country hates his.
Your country, Kosiko?
Romania. He say my knife is not so good like his Polish one.
But I thought you were both American boys.
For Miss Brown, he say...
Kosiko starts to fight
him. Hadn't you both better just forget about it? You know, there are some things in Europe which we all like to leave behind when we come to the United States. Hatreds and things like that. Maybe you can think of some others.
Kings.
Yes.
And fighting.
Yes, that's right. You see, these states might have become separate countries, all squabbling among themselves. But they chose instead to join together as one nation and help each other. But here, I haven't time to be talking like this. I wonder if you'll both come into the room and help me grade the spelling papers.
Oh, sure. We come. Are you on it?
Oh, sure, Miss Brown. Kosiko.
What?
Maybe you'll let me use your knife now to make good points on my pencil. My Polish knife. He is so dull.
You have heard it on the air. Now read it in type. This is the advice given by psychologists to those who want to retain the facts of educational broadcast. The United States Office of Education, the National Broadcasting Company, and the Columbia University Press publish each week complete text of these scripts. You may obtain a copy of today's program by sending 10 cents to Gallant American Women, Washington, D.C. Also ready are the first 11 programs in this series. The scripts cover the stories of women and civil liberties, their efforts in behalf of peace, women on the land, women as providers, women and the law, and other themes. A complete list of all available scripts is included with each published script. Address your request with 10 cents to Gallant American Women, Washington, D.C. Next week, Women as Explorers, and the week following, Women of Letters, the story of women historians, essayists, novelists, and poets. Why not tell your friends about this series? We invite you and your friends to tune in each week at this same time to Gallant American Women. Gallant American Women, an NBC public service feature, is a series of dramatizations prepared and presented by the United States Office of Education, Federal Security Agency, with the cooperation of the Women's Division of NBC and with the assistance of the Works Project Administration. Script by Jane Ashman, program supervised by Eva Hansel. Historical consultant, Mrs. Mary R. Beard of the World Center for Women's Archives, and Dr. Eugenie Leonard. Original music by Rudolf Schramm. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.